Well, auction results can often be puzzling, but never more so than last month when the answer to one of the world's most famous puzzles fetched a huge price not long after that very secret was found in a museum for free. The puzzle in question is Kryptos, the sculpture by Jim Sanborn, which sits outside the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. It was created in 1990, and it has a complex series of puzzles embedded in it, which people have been trying to crack ever since. John Schwartz is a professor of practice at the UT Austin School of Journalism and Media at the University of Texas. He's also a former New York Times journalist who started writing about the Kryptos sculpture in 1999 and in a way became part of the puzzle himself. John, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you.
Firstly, could you describe the sculpture, Kryptos, for us?
The first thing to understand about the Kryptos sculpture is it is beautiful. It is a very moving piece of sculpture. There's a winding scroll of copper that is several feet high, and it has thousands of characters, of letters, hand-drilled through the copper. And this scroll is surrounded by water and stones, and everything about it exudes mysterious meaning. Being around that piece of art, it just feels powerful. It's an amazing piece.
That's fascinating, and it does sound amazing. And I suppose in a way, people have maybe distracted from the art by the puzzle aspect of it. But could you tell us how the puzzles came to be embedded in the art and the sort of infuriating searches that that's led to ever since?
Absolutely. Jim Sanborn, the artist, is very technical and intellectual in many ways. And when he got the commission from the CIA, he got to work with the former chief cryptologist of the CIA. And Ed Scheidt taught Jim elements of cryptography so that they were doing vignette tables and all these other things that I barely understand. And so Jim was able to create four passages that were messages of the sculpture, and they were encrypted in different ways. The first three were solved pretty much by the mid-late 90s. That amateur cryptographers had said, wait, I know this, or they had done their tables, they had done their frequency analyses, and they had found messages that sort of led one along the other. Some of the people who were able to do this were actual professional people working at the CIA and the National Security Agency, NSA, and others were just really smart amateurs using the tools that they could work with. And one by one, the first three passages fell. And my first story in 99 was the unveiling, or the fact that these things had come to light. But there was a fourth passage, which is called K4. And that one had not been cracked. It wasn't cracked then. It hasn't been solved even now. And part of that is that it was only 97 characters long, and the longer a message is, the easier it is to break. But really, the fact that there's this 97-character piece still out there 35 years later really does excite the mind. And the sort of people who want to solve puzzles, who want to be known as the person who cracked that, cannot resist it. It is just an object of global fascination.
Absolutely. We should just check as well, John. I'm assuming that the encrypted messages in the sculpture don't give away any national secrets or anything that would embarrass the CIA, as far as we're aware.
No, in fact, one of the things the CIA required of Jim Sanborn was that he show them that the messages didn't, even though they would not reveal the messages, they came up with this complicated way for him to show a group of people in the CIA, I think history office, that that he had information. He could show them what it was basically going to say without giving them the answer, and that they could see he wasn't giving anything up. There's a reference to the opening of King Tut's tomb. There are, you know, there are historical references, but it's nothing about here's where we keep the nuclear codes.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with John Schwartz. And John, you mentioned your first story about the Kryptos sculpture. As I said, you then sort of became involved in the puzzle a bit yourself. Could you tell us about that?
Well, over the years, Sanborn would decide people haven't moved forward on this last 97-character passage. And so I'm going to give a clue And so we would get on the phone and he would tell me about the latest clue and I would write up a story. And the story would appear in the New York Times, which is where I was working. My first story was in the Washington Post. Then I went over to the New York Times. And that's where these other stories came up. 5 years later, he would say, still no movement. I'm ready to drop another clue. And I would do another story. And, you know, one of the wonderful things about the Times is that, first of all, they love stuff like this. Second, they have this amazing graphic staff. So Jonathan Corum created beautiful images that showed sort of blinking through the clues and showing what is known and what is still unknown. Earlier this year, I got in touch with Jim again, and he said, you know, we, in the past, we've talked about the fact that as I get older, I'm worried about this thing still being secret after I'm gone. Mm. And I want somebody to be able to maintain the secret and help people who are asking whether they've solved it. But more than that, I want to be done. I don't want to answer the questions anymore. Thousands of people get in touch with him to say, I've solved it. I've solved it. Here's my answer. And then he writes back, actually, that's not it. And it gets old. Yeah. And so an auction house agreed to sell the secret and other Kryptos-related items, like a proof-of-concept sheet of copper that he had done. And so the auction house announced the auction, and we put it in the paper. And in that announcement, among the items that said would be sold were some sheets about the creation of Kryptos and encoding that were on file at the Smithsonian. And two guys, both a journalist and novelist and a journalist and a playwright, Jarrett Kobeck and Richard Byrne. Well, that's interesting. I wouldn't know that the stuff was at the Smithsonian. And Richard lives in the Washington area. And Jarrett, who is the real Kryptos guy, said, would you mind going down to the Smithsonian Archive of American Art and just take a look at the folders that they're talking about? And he went down and he looked and he sent images of what he saw to Jarrett, and Jarrett looked at it, and there are some scraps of paper in one folder. He says, wait a minute, this is Berlin clock. And Berlin clock is the very first big clue to the K4 thing. He says, oh, wait a minute. This says east, northeast, which was two more enormous clues that Sanborn dropped over time. And so Jarrett looks at this, and he's able to sort of sort and piece together until he has an order of 97 characters that are the answer. And he checks in with Sanborn, and Sanborn's like, yeah, that's the answer. And so this is where I come in, because they got in touch with me through a mutual friend and said, we've got the answer. This thing that you've been writing about for 35 years, we have the answer. And I don't know about you, but my journalistic instincts aren't as dull as they might seem. And I said, yeah, let's write that up.
Absolutely.
That seems like a story to me. Let's write that up. And the people at the Times, I mean, I'm retired from the Times. I'm teaching journalism. But they said, yeah, that's a story. You could do that. And so I interview them. I interview Sanborn. I interview the auction house and put together a story about whether this ruins the auction, for one thing, because they're selling the secret. But on top of that, there's the question of, did they really solve anything? This is what the true Kryptos fanatics are most concerned about. Did you figure out how to do it? And the answer is no. Hmm. We didn't solve the puzzle. We found the solution to the puzzle. And that's a really important distinction to people for whom this is an important distinction. And so in pulling this together, they've done something interesting. What they said, what Byrne said to me about this was, this is like open source intel. This is where, instead of spy agencies putting boots on the ground somewhere where people will get into trouble, you look through the newspapers and public access reports and solve the question. And so they definitely had the answer. And so that turned into a story as well. And then finally, the auction did come off a couple of weeks ago, and the secret sold for near $1 million.
Yes, well, and that is in some ways arguably the second most puzzling thing about the whole story. Before we get to that, though, I'd just like to step back and hear a little bit more about some of those conversations when this story about the solution sitting in the Smithsonian emerged. What did Jim Sanborn say about that, and what was his attitude to it? Was that an intentional act?
Well, he was devastated. First of all, because first of all, he's close to the auction and he felt he was getting out. And having this happen so close to the finish line and having it be because of a mistake on his part, he didn't intend for the solution to be in a folder in the Smithsonian. But he had started putting together his papers for the archive. And as he told me, he was doing it at a time when he was fighting cancer and was sick and in a sort of a frenzy to get it all done. And he just wasn't paying close enough attention to what went into those folders. Then when the auction house said, and by the way, there's this stuff in folders at the Smithsonian, our guys, Kobeck and Byrne, had a clue. And so they found something that Sanborn never intended to make its way into the public domain. Mm. And so it's not like he was upset with them. I mean, things deteriorated and people got angry with each other because Sanborn initially said, well, if you just sign a non-disclosure agreement, maybe you can share some of the proceeds. And to Kobeck and Byrne, this felt like an ethical problem. I've said this to other people and they've said, why wouldn't they just take the money? There's a range of opinion here, but both of them coming from a journalistic background said, I couldn't possibly do that. And I certainly couldn't not talk about having done this. And so this thing reached an impasse and there were some tempers involved. At the same time, they admire Sanborn and his work. And he recognized that they had done something genuinely interesting, but he was upset. Then, you know, as things worked out, the auction house realized that what they had to do was to disclose that the information had been uncovered.
Yes, indeed, because I was going to ask about that. I was going to perhaps cynically say that it might not be impossible that auction houses might talk up their items sometimes and potentially not disclose critical details, but that didn't happen in this case.
No, and you can imagine them wanting it just to go away. But in fact, they did the right thing. They disclosed, and in their disclosures, this has come out, but the two men have agreed not to reveal the secret. And so the idea that the whole auction would be blown because everybody would know it, and you could just read it on the front page of the New York Times, that threat went away, and the auction went forward. I think the top bid was $770,000, and then there's the auction house reserve. And as I said, it came to close to $1 million, which is, you know, not bad.
Absolutely. Is that less than what was expected before the Smithsonian twist?
The estimate of the auction value was between $300,000 and $500,000. And so the idea was that it far exceeded what their estimate was. Now, did they possibly dream it could go much, much higher if a bunch of rich Silicon Valley types got into bidding wars? Maybe, but this was almost double the high end of their estimate.
I must say, John, that when I read the revised copy of the auction house talking about the auction representing something more valuable than access to a solution itself, I found myself wondering whether they were sort of gilding the lily a little bit. But do you think in the end this story has vindicated that sentiment?
I never had a strong sense of what they were selling in the first place, right? But what they were selling was access to the secret, which has this ephemeral value, but also this beautiful piece of copper sculpture that Sanborn did, which I saw images of, and other ephemera. It's possible altogether that it reached the advertised value. But boy, do I not understand auctions. I mean, you know, boy, do I not understand spending $1 million. I wear shoes until they fall apart. I drive old cars. I'm not that guy. So understanding the millionaire mindset, you need someone else to answer this question.
John, have you had the chance to speak to Jim Sanborn since the auction?
Well, as you can imagine, we have a long sort of telephone interviewer relationship. that he expects me to, you know, check in on things. And the night of the auction, when the gavel went down, and before my story was finished, I called his cell phone to get a comment. And he picked up the phone and he was laughing. And he said, I had a bet with my wife over whether you would be the first person to call or the auction house. And apparently I won.
That's good to hear. And he was clearly laughing about the timing of the call. Do you have a sense of whether he's come out of this process that was intended in one way, but then had an unintended and unexpected twist? Has he come out of it with some peace of mind?
I think so. The fact is, he has turned 80 years old. He wanted to set aside his involvement with the sculpture, and he has done that. And that's really the biggest thing. He has wanted to make sure that it will be with someone who wants to maintain the process and the system. And the buyer has stated that that is the intention, to keep this thing going and to help people know whether they've solved it or not, to keep things going. And getting his share of the bid, I mean, as he's told me, now that he's in his ninth decade, there are health issues ahead and there are things he wants to do with the money to sort of help charities and programs. And he's got plans, and the money will help with all of that. So as far as Jim Sanborn goes, it's a pretty good result. A lot of stress at the end to get there.
Absolutely. John, do we know who bought the auction item?
I've asked. The buyer preferred to remain anonymous, but I've put in a request and said, you know, when somebody's ready to talk to me, I'm ready to talk. Because isn't that a story too?
And so still the solution to K4, not so much the answer, but actually solving K4 remains a challenge which is open. Is that the only thing that remains to be solved from the original sculpture?
Well, no, there's an additional mystery that Sanborn has referred to as K5 that flows from what we find out about K4. And I have heard many, many theories about it. I don't know which is which, but apparently it all ties together in the end as a whole. And I just hope I live long enough to see it.
John, when you interviewed Jarrett Kobeck and Richard Byrne, did they tell you the answer?
I prefer not to say.
So we'll take that. I think we can run with that. Do you envisage teaching the ethical issues that these journalists encountered as part of your role as professor of practice at UT Austin School of Journalism?
I take everything that happens in the news and I use it in my courses. I'm very thrifty that way. And so I've talked with my students about this event and many others. Everything is fodder for the course.
Well, John, it's been great speaking with you. And if you do happen to know the secret, just be very careful about which of your papers you donate to the Smithsonian. We don't want to see this happening again. But it's been a great pleasure speaking with you on Sunday Extra.
Julian, thank you so much for having me.
That's John Schwartz, the former New York Times journalist and the journalist of choice of the sculptor Jim Sanborn, as we heard. And John is also the professor of practice at the UT Austin School of Journalism and Media at the University of Texas.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.